upon all who teach and all who learn. Send thy special blessing upon those who are to receive degrees from this institution this afternoon, and grant that in all humility of spirit they may ever look unto thee, who art the fountain of all wisdom, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Friends and relations of the graduating class and members of the faculty, on behalf of the class of 1955, I bid you a cordial welcome. Although the traditional commencement address makes reference to the cold, cruel world, this one will not, because we have so much confidence in the future of our class. Student prospects in business and industry are improving. A higher value is being placed on a college education. The knowledge and experience which we have gained at Cal Poly will enable us to take our place in society as good citizens. We have been given a foundation upon which to build our future. These things which we are taking from Cal Poly, we will try to use to the fullest extent. For the education we have received, the members of the class of 1955 say thank you to the state of California and to the people of that state for the important part they played. For the guidance we have received, this class says thanks to President McPhee, the dean, the department head, the instructors, and to all the members of the Cal Poly staff. We are leaving you today, but we do not feel that we will be entirely separated from Cal Poly, for we will take with us many cherished memories and friendships, and we will always remember that we are a part of Cal Poly.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege today to present the senior class gift. This year's senior class, knowing how much a student union is needed here at Cal Poly for the students, has decided as a gift to send a check to the school, and this check will go towards refurnishing and remodeling the now temporary student union. So without further ado at this time, I'd like to present this check to President McPhee from the class of 1955.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the students' body of the California State Polytechnic College, on behalf of the California State Polytechnic College itself, we are very grateful for this check. I'm sure that the students for many, many years ahead will keep this in memory of this class of 1955. This afternoon, known not only as a leading industrialist, but also as a friend of higher education. A graduate of the University of California, he is a member of the Board of Trustees of Cornell University, which he attended as an undergraduate for 2 years, and as a member of the Board of Trustees of the University of Southern California. As an industrial leader, he has been president of Consolidated Steel Corporation, and since 1938, is president of the Union Oil Company of California. In 1942, he served as chief of the iron and steel branch of the War Production Board. Not only is he active in these educational and industrial matters, but he is giving his time generously in serving on boards of directors of many civic and philanthropic organizations. It is my pleasure to present as our honored guest and the speaker of this occasion, the president of the Union Oil Company of California, Reese H. Taylor.
President McPhee, members of the faculty, honored graduates, and friends, I hope today to share with you some ideas that may be of interest and of help to you. I hasten to add, these are not my own ideas exclusively. They are being reported to you because I believe they are true. I am here to talk to you about some of the economic facts of life. What are they as they affect you and your world in the year 1955? First, you are graduating at the best possible time anyone could graduate. No students have ever had so many magnificent opportunities awaiting them as you have awaiting you. Industry has pushed its capacity to produce the material things of life to an all-time high. Automation is just around the corner. Indeed, in some industries like the automotive, it has partially rounded the corner. The machine, now a complete servant of man, has at once enriched the world with the goods of mass production and freed man for the leisure to enjoy them. With a newfound capacity to make the goods of this world, we have also invented a revolutionary ability to share what we produce. For the first time in the history of the world, the man who operates the machine is the best customer of what it makes. Mass production has made mass customers. No country in the annals of time lives so well and has in every respect so much to live for. The mark of progress and of opportunity is everywhere around us. Science is daily finding new answers to its $64 question. Yesterday's theorems are today's new industries. Medicine continues to conquer men's most serious illnesses. The fact of physical survival is being made more commonplace every day. And in a very real sense, there is no longer so very much difference between capital, management, and labor. We are all, from time to time, customers of each other in perpetuating the success of America's free competitive economy. These are the economic facts of life. They are very real. But there is another fact of life which is very true, though frequently overlooked. All of this will mean nothing to you unless you are consistently willing to take the big chance instead of settling only for the sure thing. All of this opportunity will avail you nothing if you fear to meet its challenge and seek only that dead-end street named security. I don't wish to emphasize this point unduly, and if I do, it is because the security symptoms of our generation disturb me deeply. I've talked to many young men about their careers in, for example, the petroleum industry. Now, they were healthy, fine, and well-educated, and frequently brilliant young men. What shocked me most was their almost unanimous concern for the kind of security the petroleum industry offered, rather than the nature of its challenges and its rewards for successfully meeting those challenges. I don't think my experience in this matter is singular either. I have discussed the subject with executives of other industries. They report a similar concern for the security-mindedness of the current generation. Now, what is this security which is valued so highly? I looked the word up in the dictionary, and this is what it said. Security, freedom from exposure to danger, protection, safety or place of safety, freedom from anxiety or doubt. Now, if we accept this definition on its own face value, and it's a good one, it seems to me that the most secure people are those unfortunates in our state and federal prisons. They have to take no chances to earn a living. They're assured of food and shelter and freedom from exposure to danger, or the need to earn their way in competition with other able men. They're guaranteed a place of safety, so to speak, for a specific number of years. But of course, this reduces the point to the absurd. I'm quite certain this is not the kind of security men have in mind when they query prospective employers about retirement plans, sickness and accident provisions, and old age insurance programs. And there is certainly nothing the matter per se with any of these things. But it is necessary to understand another very important fact of life, that none of these securities are possible unless somebody earns them. The song says the best things in life are free. Don't be deluded. They're bought and fought for, they're purchased and they're earned. How? By doing ordinary things extraordinarily well. In short, by producing. Producing, that is the only way any company can possibly afford to put part of its profits into retirement programs, insurance benefits, or what have you. That is why people delude themselves if they look only to the government for security. For of itself, the government produces nothing. It earns nothing except what you give it in taxes. The only way a government can possibly give back any kind of security is for all of us to produce enough to be able to pay taxes and therefore keep the government in business. That is why you delude yourself if you look only for job security. That false presumption that seeks the guarantees of the job rather than the challenge in it. That seeks in mere tenure a substitute for the fresh idea, the new approach, the daring departure, the bold adventure, the untried avenue, the hazardous guess, and the breathtaking chance. I do not believe, if you will think about it, that this is the kind of world you really want. I believe it to be a very gray and neutral prospect.
I was told about this train earlier.
I began to think maybe I was going to beat it today, but a world where there is no incentive to be any better or do any better or know any better, because you are, from birth to death, free from exposure to new methods, safe from the stimulation of new ideas, protected from challenge, and insulated against change. Such an economic climate would not do justice even to an old people's home, let alone a young and muscular nation. That is why you should seek the only kind of economic security worth having, the only practical job security, the only feasible target for people with youth and ambition. And that is the security that comes from producing on the job, the security that springs from the ability to do your work at least as well as or better than the next man, and the confidence you derive from this knowledge. For in this attitude, there is strength and value and optimism and a willingness to take a chance. Nothing that has made this country great was accomplished without this willingness. Indeed, the history of America is an adventure story. It is a saga of risk-takers, of people who've had a cosmic contempt for security and an everlasting curiosity for the next new opportunity. The fact is, if security were the first goal and consideration of our forebears, this continent would never have been discovered. It certainly would not now be settled from coast to coast. If security were the prime objective, the cotton gin would never have been invented, nor the steam engine and gasoline motor. I don't know whether it's bothering you or not, but
well, it will now.
If security were the paramount idea, we would never have dared to secede from England, nor fight two wars against dictators. If security were the be-all and end-all, we would long since have been under the totalitarian thumb where a man's thoughts, as well as his life, are securely planned for him. This is another major fact of life to carry with you today. You do not inherit an old world, a used-up empire, or a senile democracy. You inherit the new world, a young and vigorous country that has barely flexed its muscles, a bold and adventurous nation that was discovered and settled and developed by men and women who frequently failed in the big chance, but never failed to take it. And every advance that they made, it seems to me, was made by their walking toward opportunity and away from security for security's sake alone. And every danger they met and conquered created new opportunity for those who came after. So today, in America's long history of opportunity, you are graduating at the most opportune time of all. You have an economic inheritance second to none. You are young, you are gifted, you are trained. But are you eager and are you optimistic? This is the next to last fact of life I shall talk about, but it may well be the most important of them all. It is this: life always has a greater reward for the optimist than it does for the pessimist. I hope that this is not so simple a statement that you will miss its meaning. Little in life is as important as attitude, the right attitude. Sometimes it seems to be all there is to living successfully. Yes, you can make mistakes in being optimistic, but there are very few men who have lived any length of time who won't honestly admit that given their lives to live over, they would be infinitely better off if they had taken the optimistic approach to most of the problems they met. For example, that I've said that you are graduating at the best possible moment in history. If you are optimistic, there is a chance that you will believe this, and believing it benefits. But if you are chronically pessimistic in your approach to life, you might possibly question that statement. Well, then, in what year would you rather graduate? Pick one at random. 1879? That's as good a year as any. If I were bringing you this message then instead of now, you might honestly differ with me. Where, you might ask, is opportunity in this year? Where indeed? That was the time a man named Edison invented the incandescent bulb. The world came out of the shadows of gaslight, and the electrical age was won. 1903, another year you could have been graduating, but where was opportunity then? In Detroit? A man who had withdrawn from the Detroit Automobile Company 2 years ago, or 2 years before, took the plunge and went into business for himself. His name was Henry Ford. In that same year, from the base of Kill Devil Hill, North Carolina, a lumbering, heavier-than-air plane, piloted by Orville Wright, rose 120 feet and stayed aloft 12 seconds. Thus, in 1 year, the nation suddenly found wheels and wings. 1907, the year DeForest perfected the radio vacuum tube and made possible long-distance telephone and radio. Are you thinking of 1929, 30, 31, our Depression years, and wondering where you'd find opportunity if you were graduating then? Well, sometimes satisfy your curiosity. Look up the number of young presidents of corporations and founders of new businesses who did finish school in those years, and you may be surprised. Still later, we had commercial television, nonstop coast-to-coast air travel, undreamed of in my youth. Today, we stand on the threshold of the atomic age. What of tomorrow? Ahead lie undreamed of things in transportation, medicine, electronics, chemistry, and in agriculture, where 1 acre will now produce what 2 acres did 15 years ago. What indeed of tomorrow? It will be full of new wonders, new ideas, and new pioneers of progress. You will not have to be pioneers to profit by these advancements. You'll only have to believe in them and in yourself. That is perhaps the most important of all the facts of life, that all opportunity is, in truth, not so much in the times of man as in the eye of the beholder. Therefore, I hope that you are restless. I hope you are eager. I hope you are confident. And I hope you seek the challenge, because it is your responsibility to keep the dream of America alive, to be as good and as big and as brave and as optimistic as the opportunity you have before you. I thank you very much.
Since 1894, when you first engaged in farming in Santa Clara County, you have been continuously a leader in the promotion of better agriculture and have achieved an outstanding reputation for work in the field of the Farmers Cooperative. Your leadership is exemplified by the positions you have held as state president of the Farmers Educational Cooperative Union of America from 1921 to 1946, and as director since 1927 of the California Prune and Apricot Growers Association, and as state president since 1946 of the California Farmers Incorporated. You have brought better understanding of the farmers' problems to urban populations and have influenced many young men to engage in agriculture as a career through your civic participation and leadership. As a member and officer of the California State Board of Agriculture from 1931 to 1939, as chairman of the Agricultural Committee of the California Commission for the Golden Gate International Exposition from 1937 to 1941, as director and president of the Santa Clara County Fair Association, and as director and charter member of the Agriculture Committee of the State Chamber of Commerce. Your activities have not been limited to agriculture and civic affairs, but have extended into business leadership as a member of the Board of Governors of the Farmers Insurance Exchange and as chairman of that board since 1930. Few men in California have had so much influence in the promotion of agriculture in this state. And whereas this great and valuable service to the California has been only partially recognized by awarding to you in 1939 of the Future Farmers of America Honorary State Farmer degree, therefore, by authority of the invested me by President of California State Polytechnic College, confer upon you the honorary degree of Master in Science in Public Service with all the rights and privileges pertaining thereto.
Thank you, Mr. President McPhee. You know, folks, I've always felt that I was close to the California Polytechnic College. I've always wanted to belong to it. Now, with this degree, you can't get rid of me. And I hope I'll be able to serve you as well in the future as what Julian says or indicates that I've done in the past. I thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a result of establishing a unit of the Reserve Officers Training Program at California State Polytechnic College in 1952, the class of 1955 has within it the first group of candidates for commission in the Army of the United States. It is therefore with a great deal of personal pleasure and pride, too, that I will administer the oath of office to these candidates, which will confirm their commissions in the Army. Will the candidates for commission raise their right hand and repeat after me? I, state your full name. Having been appointed a second lieutenant, Army of the United States, do solemnly swear that I will defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign or domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same,
that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, that I will well and faithfully execute the office upon which I'm about to enter. So help me God. Thank you. A telegram from the Honorable Robert T. Stevens, Secretary of the Army, welcoming these young men into the Army, and I would like to add, as head of the military department, that I too welcome them and commend them for a job well done. President McPhee, members of the class of 1955, honored guests, and fellow faculty members. On behalf of the faculties of the San Luis Obispo and Kellogg Voorhees campuses of the California State Polytechnic College, it is my privilege to announce that 391 students comprising the class of 1955 have satisfactorily completed all requirements for graduation and are now eligible to receive their degrees or certificates. 27 of today's graduates are candidates for the Master's of Arts degree in education. Of the 342 Bachelor of Science candidates, 185 have completed their work in agriculture. I think that's a good place to stop. Seven of today's graduates are candidates for the Master of Arts degree in education. Of the 342 Bachelor of Science candidates, 185 have completed their work in agriculture, 126 in engineering, and 31 in the liberal arts division. Four students have met requirements for the 3-year technical certificate, and 18 for the two-year certificate. One member of this class, to whom we owe an immeasurable debt of gratitude for his many years of continued interest in and active support of this college, has already received his honorary degree. Today marks the first Reserve Officer Training Corps graduation in Cal Poly history. 7 senior cadets have received commissions in the various branches of the Army of the United States. 39 members, or 10% of today's class, are graduating with honors, which means that for all work taken, the grades received average higher than a grade of B. Members of the class of 1955 come from 160 different California cities and towns, 25 other states, from Nevada to Massachusetts, and Texas to Wisconsin, and the territories of both Alaska and Hawaii are represented. There are graduates here from 11 foreign countries. One third, or 132 of today's graduates, are veterans. Of the 391 graduates, 149 are married, according to today's count. There will be more tomorrow. The 149 wives received their PhD, pushing hubby through degrees, last Sunday. I am told on good authority that without exception, each wife felt it sufficiently important to stand by until today to witness this occasion, just to make certain that the man of the house actually met his obligation and received his diploma. To the class of 1955, may I say that your instructors and your fellow students are a bit sad on the occasion of your leaving Cal Poly. May we wish you every success and trust that your memories of pleasant experiences here will cause you to return to the campus many times in the future. Those who have preceded you in earlier years have brought great credit to themselves and to the college. We believe that you will do likewise. President McPhee, it is indeed an honor to present to you this graduating class of 1955. President McPhee, the class of 1955.
Thank you, Dean McCarthy. You've been a grand class. We hate to see you go. We know each and every one of you will be a huge success. We hope that you won't forget Cal Poly, that you'll come back to visit as often as you possibly can. Before I give you the diplomas, I'm going to repeat a suggestion made by President Taylor of the Union Oil Company. He suggested that next year we have President Russell of the Southern Pacific Company come down and give our commencement address. At this time, I'll give out the diploma.
Under God's gracious mercy and protection, we commit you. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up the light of his countenance upon you and give you peace, both now and evermore. Amen.
solely responsible.
Meet John Hannigan.
He's a friend of Bob Hurley.
Both of you gentlemen.